Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, we'll be talking to Professor Clara Han about her new book, Seeing Like a Child, Inheriting the Korean War. Clara, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. I'm really excited to talk about your wonderful book that is so different from any other scholarship that I have seen. And I'm sure the listeners are really excited as well. Clara, I wonder if we can begin the interview with you telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I am Clara Han. I'm an anthropologist. I am an associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at Johns Hopkins University. I've worked for a long time on issues of poverty and health and state violence, mainly in actually for a long time in Chile and Santiago, Chile, and low-income neighborhoods. And more recently, as you see with this publication, Seeing Like a Child, I've started to kind of think through questions of violence and subjectivity, starting with my own family, in the context of Korea.
Yeah, and you talk about this in the introduction of your book, how you came to write Seeing Like a Child, but I wonder whether you could also tell the listeners about how you came to write Seeing Like a Child, which is so different from your previous work.
This book project really, it didn't really start out as a book project per se. It hadn't been conceived of as a book project. It really started out as a conversation with my friend, who at the time was a graduate student, actually. He's now a colleague, really thinking through the memories, the inheritance of, or inheritance of familial memories of catastrophe, from his perspective of his grandparents who had been survivors of the Holocaust. And from my perspective in terms of how it is that that our family has inherited the catastrophe of the Korean War. And so it was a kind of ongoing conversation that we would have, like chats and having coffee with each other and so forth. And we were invited to give a paper at a conference about this. We had been talking to other people about this. And so this was our first attempt. We essentially started by writing and just kind of like allowing memories to kind of come to us like a rush on the page. And then we would trade our writings with each other and read them and then have a conversation. And it became this process of writing, allowing these memories to rush to the page and then discuss them, that became the basis of the book. So eventually I kind of took this experiment forward more fully by essentially writing this book. And that's how it kind of started to take shape. So this wasn't something that I thought about by myself or, sitting in front of a desk by myself, but actually was very much an expression of both my family and also the intellectual community that I'm embedded in.
I remember, you did write about that in the introduction, and I also thought it was interesting how the foreword is provided by a fellow scholar, and I wonder whether you can comment on the importance of these like intellectual communities that you had in graduate school, and then I guess now you're teaching at Johns Hopkins, so within the academic spaces that you have migrated across.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, I think that what was really interesting about this writing this this work this is this the fact that this intellectual community that I am in and try to sustain is very much interested in and committed to thinking through or thinking at the the margins of the discipline, right? And it's not just, I mean, and it's really, you know, so in a sense, it actually brings out, you know, some of the questions around how we think of self-knowledge and anthropological knowledge, right? Like this, is anthropological knowledge simply professionalized knowledge, or how do we think about the ways in which self-knowledge and anthropological knowledge actually are imprinted on each other? And so, you know, Richard Reckman, for example, who wrote the foreword of the book, is a psychiatrist and anthropologist who's worked with Cambodian refugees in France for a very long time. And he wrote, he has done a lot of work, not simply on a critique of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, or a critique of the discourse of trauma, but rather he tries to get inside what it is to inhabit an everyday life that's within within death, if you will, like in the context of genocide. And so he tries to kind of make available that subjective experience that is in excess of the categories that disciplinary knowledge makes available, that is either within anthropology or within psychiatry. And likewise, you know, Vina Das, who many of us know in the humanities and social sciences, has been really important in, you know, just working with her has been extremely important for my own growth as a scholar and a person, in the sense that she has presented most powerfully to me and to many others, but for myself, how to kind of a way in which we might think of thought as a movement of descent, and rather than actually try to grasp for a super concept in order to kind of put experience onto a grid, it rather is the movement would really be to have that open curiosity to actually gain an attentiveness to words, right? To the life and death of words among us. And that, I think, you know, comes with a lot of methodological challenges, and that that's those sets of conversations that, in a sense, I think, you know, in a way, allowed me to receive the experiences in my family in ways that I hadn't been able to before. So that's why I don't think that there is a very neat, you know, cut or, you know, secure boundary between self-knowledge and anthropological knowledge. I couldn't have written this book without the life that I've had, right? But I wouldn't have been able to have the experience available had I not actually been open to this kind of anthropological knowledge or exposed to it. So because I have had the life that I've had, that knowledge also resonates with me, right? So it's not quite clear to me what the, you know, I think that there's these ways in which self-knowledge and anthropological knowledge are imprinted on each other.
Yeah, exactly. And you talk about that with, you know, perspective of a child as well, when you criticize how I is often seen as a fully formed like person with, you know, the categories of the war and history that is really defined, that informs anthropological practices. So you criticize that in your book, which I thought was just very beautifully put. But I wondered, because I was thinking about that with my work as well, and I found it very inspiring. Like, what was the process like for you to try to like recover this voice of the child without recoursing to the neat narratives of like adulthood and like the preset categories that the scholarship really relies on?
I think that it's really a question of, for myself, it was really a question of having a fidelity to the memory. And so, for example, I would give examples, right? For example, I could tell you I remember when I was being tested they would give these IQ tests to children at that time. And so I was being tested in order to figure out what grade I would be placed in. An adult might relate it in terms of for an adult memory of that child, it's like, oh, well, and then, I was tested and I was put into this room and they were giving me these standardized tests. But, as a child, I didn't know what a standardized test was. Right? Like that category, standardized test, did not even exist to me yet. Like standardization did not exist to me yet. So so if I were to actually stay true to that particular memory, it would be, describing what I see in my mind, for example, is that the boots of the test of the woman who was testing me, she had these brown boots, big brown boots. And then she kept staring out the window and saying, and she would say, "Tell me the difference between a brick house and a wood house." And I said, and I was, just waffling. She's like, and then she would just repeat, and she just stares out the window and says, "A brick house or a wood house?" And so you just, so it's that kind of description, right, of these impressions, that is not necessarily one that you're going to, and what does that tell you? That kind of, that detail, right, what the child kind of remembers. I can actually, for example, even what my daughter would describe, it's very interesting to see how, only in the last, maybe I would say month or two, she's four now. Has she really mastered, in some ways, clearly absorbed narrative form? Like this happened, then this happened, then this. Like in relating a story, right? And before that, actually, if she went to, for example, we were in Seoul. This was when she was two, and she was so amazed by these being on buses, like so many buses, very long bus rides. People sleeping on the buses, right? And so a couple months later, after we had come back, all of a sudden she's like, looks at me and she says, the woman's head on the bus seat just bobbing up and down. And I'm like, she's like, the dark tunnel. And I said, what? And it was just kind of like, whoa. But the reason I could understand what she was saying was because I actually had a much larger world with her. I share the world with her, right? And so then I thought, black, dark, long tunnels, a woman's head bobbing on the bus seat. When has that happened? That has happened in Seoul. She's talking about, this. And it's like these kind of impressions that are these almost like non-linearly strung together, almost like this kind of weave of impressions, which actually somewhat reminds me of Hangang's, memoir, this weave of impressions is actually, how the child relates this memory, the very small child relates these memories, right? Before simply locking these into narrative. And even now, even as Ella has, absorbed narrative form, it's not that she's simply relating her experience in narrative form, because it's not like a developmental question where you reach a stage and then everything else falls away. It's that form now resides next to these other ways of relating your world, right?
Mm, yeah.
And so it's, instead of actually kind of emphasizing that impulse in us to have that linear narrative form or these particular adult categories that show a kind of false mastery. I really, really try to just go into how I don't know how to explain describe it better than write from the inside of memory, and see actually what difference does that make? You know, like what does that make available to us and to myself in understanding how catastrophe is dispersed in everyday life.
Yeah. And that relates to the part one of your book, Loss and Awakenings. Also, what is interesting about, you know, what you were telling us about with Ella and how she suddenly, you know, randomly says, oh, you know, the third tunnel, and then you can reference it back to Soul. So there's also an interesting overlap between like spaces and temporality. So they're not necessarily linear or logical, quote unquote. But then they're kind of like interspersed and like intersecting one another. And that's also what you talk about in the part one, when you talk about how the catastrophe of war is seeped into everyday domestic realms in terms of, you know, your mother's stroke and, you know, the traumatic experiences that you had in Los Alamos. And even though you weren't directly experiencing the Korean War itself, the fantasy world that you had about, oh, you know, your mom being a princess, and then, you know, your dad also like his trauma with having been dispersed at Isan Gajok, displaced families, that also all interlocking together to inform your own childhood and your understanding of yourself. So I found that to be like hugely interesting as well. So I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about how this, you know, how the trauma of the Korean War and displacement that your parents experienced informed your own childhood and your self identity.
So yeah, actually, I just wanted to kind of I wanted to actually back up a little bit in terms of the questions of trauma, and I think that that's actually, I mean, one of the, issues has been really to try to kind of work around the discourse of trauma rather than be within the model of trauma, because one of because the model of trauma does is based on a notion of the event that actually is something that you can point to, such to the extent that the event it's like to the extent that it's not the individual per se that, or the collective, like the family that matters, but rather the wound that actually stands in for singularity. And so that, and we've seen that with, the way in which the institutional apparatus of trauma works, in legal regimes in relation to cases of, for example, mass rape. We've seen this, So I think that there are some issues with thinking through the model of trauma, and even to the extent of actually saying that this is a question of a transmission of trauma. What I'm trying to show in the book, and what I've really is really that it's not so much a question of a transmission of an event of like those who directly experience then pass it on through these various symptoms to the children, which is, there is a theory of this, this kind of transgenerational haunting and so forth. But rather is to really see how a child actually comes to inherit, that is to say, inherit as in, claim as one's own, in building the world, the child world, right? Making intelligible a world for oneself. How does catastrophe come to be marked within the child world, right? And so it's actually a different model, as it were, framework for engaging the problem of catastrophe and violence. And so, and to actually also, you know, say, well, what is a, you know, when we say this is world annihilating violence versus, you know, the kind of routinized forms of violence, you know, poverty, like how do we actually, you know, or like there's these small violences and big violences, you know, it's also trying to kind of destabilize that. I mean, in a sense, the war is not simply just that my father and my mother actually were displaced by war and then had a, you know, and then this happened in terms of illness, but rather it is in fact actually that, you know, the illness, the affliction in the household is actually was and has been catastrophic, right? And that catastrophe of a loss of home is actually what in some ways makes available the catastrophe of displacement and war in our lives. And so, I was surprised to discover for myself. I didn't know this, really quite know it in the sense of being aware and awake to this myself. But when I came to actually write from within the memories of my childhood, what first emerges is the affliction, right? With my mother, but affliction is never simply just one individual. It's actually these relationships, right? And so it's there that I actually kind of started to think through how we might think of war as embedded within within affliction. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you so much for clarifying that as well. I wasn't familiar with the trauma scholarship, but then, I mean, you do talk about it in your work, but I think talking to you about it is like also like helping me to like really clarify my understanding of it as well. And I guess it also relates to the foreword that's written by Reckman, and then you do write about how in a way, like, yeah, there is a break in scholarship between, yeah, the big traumatic events versus, you know, the small domestics. But then your purpose is to show that, to deconstruct and, like, destabilize that boundary. So, yeah, thank you so much for clarifying that. And that actually leads me to the next question, which is, I think it's like very related because you criticize the theory on racial melancholia as an insufficient concept because in a way it doesn't reject the dominant narrative of, you know, the racialized, like, you know, wanting to assimilate and provides like presents like a very singular, like one-sided portrayal of the racialized, like you know, always wanting to be like within this dominant. And you show with your example of your dad and how he rejects Korea as a country, and in a way, like how for him he wanted to be like assimilated, and it didn't fit into this like concept of racial melancholia. And you also says that, you know, you can see it rather as a labor of stealing rather than transmission. How you can recreate your voice through, I guess, like this like creative like processes of like appropriation and also reception and recreation through like diverse languages that you have at your disposal. So I feel like I didn't explain it as clearly as you have done in your book, but can you actually tell us more about you know, how you came to like understand this in terms of like language, and how you are kind of criticizing this notion of like, I guess, like nostalgia, like home, root country, and yeah, racial melancholia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess my issue, my concerns with around racial melancholia, I mean, it's not, is for example, when you look at the actual case studies, right? And, you know, one of the issues that I think I tried to point out in the book is that there is a certain violence when that happens when, you know, when U.S. racial politics becomes the dominant politics, by which to understand, you know, the familial memories or, the madness that comes with migration, that, and I think that what that can do, I mean, I understand the critique here. I understand the critique of this coercion of whiteness, which I in some sense also do agree with, that there is a coercion of whiteness, right? We cannot deny that. And we've seen that even more kind of in the most vitriolic form in the past year with the xenophobic, you know, discourse that has, you know, been so intensified in the United States with COVID. But I think that, you know, if I were to have a fidelity to the Korean War, right, and to my parents, right, I couldn't simply just say that the issue here is one in which they're being forced to assimilate and they're attempting to secure whiteness and thus I'm trying to secure whiteness and thus failing at securing whiteness. It's not that, right? I mean, clearly there are racial politics involved in the United States, and it's not that I'm immune to them and my family hasn't been either. But that framework really does tend to suppress the politics within Korea, right? And, you know, kind of reduce the question of Korea to simply like a site of war, like a chaos of destruction, rather than a really deep set of political, intellectual commitments, right, that have a history, right? And so this is why I do also resist that. And, you know, my father, you know, I would say that it's not only just that, as I said, it made me realize that he's not simply just rejecting Korea in general, right? He actually hates Korea, right? But he hates it because there's no way to be Korean today without being a North Korean or a South Korean. And that is what he doesn't want to have to acknowledge, you know? And that, I think, the sense of betrayal that Korea in some ways had betrayed him, right? Is what he actually kind of lived with. So he didn't want us learning Korean because it wasn't just about excelling as minority children. It was about the fact that he wanted to obliterate Korean from us, right? That is to say, obliterate it before it was born, right? And that is, it's really understanding that political affective impulse that would be different than my mother, who was, you know, really, there was such a different relationship to Korean. I mean, that is to say, the identification of herself as South Korean. She comes to Clark University in 1953, and she has hung the taegukgi up above her desk, right? You know, I mean, the way in which we were brought in as diaspora, you know, as the children of who would be part of this, you know, diaspora that would rebuild South Korea, actually, is a completely different politics than the kind of politics my dad espoused, which is not about valorizing North Korea, but rather saying neither of these places should exist at all. A complete rejection of contemporary political coordinates. Right. And so, which I think is really interesting, which also tells us, this is also how war is embedded in us. You know, the fact of that we inherit Korean in this way, which is through this kind of obliteration and this other impulse, right? But that impulse of my mother in some ways kind of gets cut short when she becomes sick, right? That we simply, this is how we might say that I inherited Korean. And so the picture of language here, and also this is one way in which I might say I learned English, right? Mm-hmm. Because this was in fact the fact that we weren't allowed to, my parents didn't speak Korean to us in the household, even though my mother would have found it so much more comfortable to speak Korean to us. Like, this is a way in which we learn English, right? And so in a way, it's to say that this, the picture of language here is not one in which it's this kind of simple accruing of linguistic abilities, right? Like, or thinking of language as simply linguistic, right? It's rather when, language in terms of how we understand how, like, words and how words and things come to meet each other. It's coming to learn what it is to be in a world, right? And so that's actually what I was trying to kind of get at in terms of language, and that would actually and then it's there that this question of finding one's voice, which I mean in the sense of this is where I think, Stanley Cavell's work is really helpful. That is actually, you might be born with, what he calls your mother tongue, right? But that you actually have to commit treason on your parents, right?
Yeah.
it's like you're like stealing your voice, right? Stealing in order to actually kind of project your own voice, right? And it's that actually that I kind of found that in a way is also the fact of my having my labor of learning in some ways also the linguistic capacity of Korean, right? Which is also the fact that I even do labor in that initially my dad had, my father had completely just thought it was bizarre, right? But now is, it actually has allowed him to have a home when actually word retrieval for him is very difficult now. So if he can speak it in, if the word comes in Korean, I still know what he's saying, and it would just be one word, right? But at least I'm able, there is an ability to be understood. Right. So I think that, so it's this question of like finding one's voice in terms of not in terms of simply of just linguistically learning Korean or any language per se, but rather that one has to actually then, come to, one has to in some ways commit treason on the parents, right? And actually find a way to actually, kind of claim one's voice through that. So it's this question of this is how culture essentially is animated, right? Because we actually have to project our own desires, right? In through our words, right?
It's a really important insight, and I really loved what you said about how like you wanted to show that language is not simply about accruing linguistic ability, but rather about how you like place things and like also like the self like in relations to others. And I think you showed that really well too, like when you talk about German and how you talk with your siblings in German and how it's like a language of childhood that brings solace and solidarity, like even when the times get difficult, and your dad enjoys that because for him it's a language of escape. Because like when he wanted to go to grad school, like German, English, and like Russian allowed him to imagine an academic life beyond Korea. So I thought those emotional like aspects to be like very emotional and relational aspects to be very illuminating as well. Yeah. That also leads me to the next question, which is in part three, kids. And talking about, you know, your relationship with your siblings, you also make a really interesting point about how, rather than seeing one's identity as a unique individual, which is often done in the, you know, liberal West, you show that, you know, sibling relations reveal the coexistence of togetherness and separateness that is simultaneously there. So I wondered whether you can tell us a little bit more about, you know, your sibling relations and how that's like, you know, marked by pain, competition, like hierarchy that stems from the parental upbringing and other things like that, and how that figured it within your own work and seeing like a child.
Mm-hmm. Just as you had said, I mean, this question within the liberal West of seeing the child as this kind of unique individual that, or even within the psychoanalytic literature, to see that the sibling who comes in as a threat to the uniqueness of the first child, right? Like, so that second sibling becomes the murderous one who's going to actually take the place of the first one, right? Yeah. So there's a way in which even as the sibling does emerge in psychoanalysis, it also becomes, it still hinges around this question of uniqueness, right? Like within the anthropological literature, the sibling relation is actually quite important. In particular sibling relations because of genealogical kinship. So that sibling relation would only be, it gains significance because of the inheritance of property, right, within the genealogical kinship regime. So, I think that what I was trying to what I kind of discovered with my writing through this is really that just as you were talking about in terms of us learning German, like the kids learning German, it was actually the fact it's children's play, right, with each other, right? The fact that we, we created this play world, like through German, right, that where we just say German words to each other, right? So like, and mix in German, English, German, and it would be this really just quite funny, just constantly joking banter, constant banter of German with each other, right? And it's that actually is not simply, it doesn't fit within the legal regime of inheritance of property, right? It's not a question of like the subsumption of the unique individual by the sibling and, you know, this kind of, but rather like, well, what is actually created through this play? It is a different world. And it actually, in a way, I started to think of it as one that in fact animated, it kind of gave life to our domestic when our domestic was a dying space, and that actually kept us alive in some ways. And so when I think about the way in which we might understand memory here, like, or inheritance, it actually kind of came to me when I was listening to one of our students give a paper on, this really amazing book, Nayanika Mukherjee's book, The Spectral Wound, her work on looking at the mass rape that had happened in the context of the partition of Bangladesh and Pakistan. Swayam Bagaria had given this very nice paper, it's since been published, on really asking, like, well, maybe it's not a question of, you know, like who inherits this, right? Who inherits this event? But maybe the question is, how is it that words bear memory? Do words themselves become encrusted with experience? So, and that actually was like, oh my gosh, like hearing that actually made me realize that what I had been writing at the time wasn't so much a question of who is inheriting, this violence or this catastrophe, but rather, as if one would be deemed to actually write the book on this, but rather that actually, what inherits memory? Like, and that can it be that German, in a way, for our household, came to be the link, like that those German words for ourselves, I'm not saying in a general sense or abstractly, but I'm saying for ourselves, came to be encrusted with the experience of affliction. And it is in saying these words, right, that, you know, that actually, and we continue to use these words amongst ourselves now, right, that bear witness to that history, right? It's the words that are bearing the witness, right? And that I think was just such a, like, actually kind of quite amazing insight that I felt kind of immersed in just in this milieu of writing and just being in conversation with others. So that was the first one. It's like, oh wow, this is what inherits. This is a question of words actually bearing witness. The second was actually, you know, this kind of goes back to this discussion of self-knowledge and anthropological knowledge, and which is around this question of separateness. And I've actually thought through the question of separateness within my research, other research that, you know, in Santiago and around, how do we think through care in the context of, you know, multiple persistent crises, situations in which, for example, you have a woman, you know, maybe the main kind of the one who has like the stable job and in a very large network of kin. And so she's responsible both for her own household, but also her sisters, and she's constantly putting out fires everywhere else, right? And how do we actually think about this question of separateness in the context in which everyone is actually, dependent on you, right? I think that when is it that you're actually, you can't help anymore, right? And so this is, I think, you know, this dawning of separateness, or we might say, really happens, as I'm writing, is within the writing with my twin brother, right? Where I describe how it is that, I mean, these are the most quotidian of things, right? It's like the most quotidian scene in which, my brother is like not able to write his college essay. He's just really just blocked, you know? And I'm like shaking him, right? And I think, I'm like thinking to myself, just like, write anything, you know, like we need to get out of this madness, write anything. And it's like, there's nothing that I can do, like absolutely nothing that I can do to make it such that the words live in my brother again, right? And it was this kind of just feeling of utter, like that I'm actually helpless. Like this is not just, a question of ignorance, or it's not just a question of, you know, defiance or just like frustration. It's just like, actually there's nothing more I can do. Right. There's always that question. It's never simply just a settled question, you know, issue. Like, no, there's nothing more I can do. That's the problem. It's like, you don't know. Right. And so I think, it's this question of this dawning of separateness actually is, you know, I think it kind of emerges to me, you know, I think with most clearly in the book and with my twin brother and also with my sister, right? But I think that I don't think I had a way of really quite understanding that, or being aware, awake to it, if you will, had I not actually been, had I not actually been reading and engaging with these questions of separateness in my research in Chile and in the wider discussion, like, for example, with Vina Das's work around and Stanley Cavallo's work on you know, finite responsibility, right? So it's like when you read something and you realize, like, whoa, like this is like a moment in which the anthropological work, like this writing, actually has the power to actually reveal aspects of your own life to yourself, right? And that I thought was really quite interesting. So
yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. And that actually reminds me of, have you read Ommai Maltukso, like by Park Wan-seo? I think in English translation is Mother's Steak by Park Wan-seo. Yeah. As you were, talking about it, it really reminded me of how, like, in the first two pages, Park Wan-seo is like a mother figure. So she later goes on to take care of her mother, but then right now, like, her daughter almost dies from a fire, and then she basically talks about how, you know, like, she thought like she was connected to her daughter because she gave birth, but then that was the moment when she realized the separateness. So in a way, but then, like, she had this promotion that, like, the daughter was in trouble of some kind, so there was, you know, the care that, like, intertwined them, but at the same time it was an incredibly, like, limited care that separated her from her daughter and then, like, later her mother. So yeah, it just really reminded me of Mother's Steak by Park Wan-seo. But yeah, it's really beautiful, and thank you so much for telling it to, like, us, like, in the audience as well during this podcast. And speaking of care, I actually did research on domestic work and care work as a master's student. So I was particularly, like, intrigued by your relationship with your sister. And especially how you talked about lethality of care and how this, you know, was gendered within your family, but also your fear of reproduction as well, like, and how your sister also experienced the same thing, that, you know, if you give birth, then in a way, like, your existence will be erased, and how you loved your sister really intensely. And then you talked about this too just now, about, you know, like, how you, like, really care for each other, and it's like a consuming care, but then at the same time there is this fear of this obliterating your existence, so this coexistence of, like, care and lethality as well as reproduction. So I actually wondered whether you could tell us more about that, because I found that to be really fascinating part of your book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I mean, this is actually, yeah, I mean, I don't think that I actually had actually, let me just put it this way, like, in my previous work in Chile, I don't think that I actually had been sufficiently aware of this question of lethality and care. Care is actually, I mean, so, you know, we might think of care in terms of like this attentiveness, right, to others, right? Or the fact that, you know, the feminist theorist of care would say, well, we're all interdependent. Right. You know, that we have to acknowledge that kind of that interdependence. Right. Or like the critique of liberal, individualism, or like even the kind of forms of political activism can take predicated on a liberal subject, because care actually shows us the dependency that we are already in. So, for example, Eva Federkite saying, for example, you know, my daughter who has, serious you know, mental disabilities would not be able to actually participate in an identity politics, right? Go do lobbying and so forth. She needs an advocate, right? And what, so then what, how does that actually shift the picture of the, this kind of, how does this actually destabilize a liberal, you know, an identity politics predicated on a liberal subject, right? So, but, you know, I think that one, what was kind of perhaps less kind of seen within that literature is this lethality to care, which is that, you know, and I kind of describe it as that which actually can, you know, unleash and, you know, the most lethal aspects of ourselves, that care, that the very physicality of care, the you know, just having to kind of be in this kind of take care of somebody in that way of, can actually really kind of bring out some of the worst, most horrible aspects of yourself. And this, I would almost think of it as like, almost like this dark lagoon that's just waiting to kind of, you know, kind of seep out into everything. And it's not so much that it's like this other is going to consume me or like the child's going to eat me, you know, this kind of thing, but rather that it's like that this very care could make me unintelligible to myself, that I would become unrecognizable to myself because of the physicality, and not just because of this dark lagoon of lethality that actually would be coming up within me with respect to care. And I think, and so that I don't want to kind of give the impression, and perhaps I did a little bit too much in that book, but it's not just that there's a question of disproportionate or gendered caregiving. I mean, that just had to happen because my mother is, you know, a woman, and me and my sister are, and there's issues, like concrete issues around taking care of somebody who's in a vegetative state, like changing clothes, like giving showers and these kind of things that, you know, we just couldn't ask my twin brother to do. Like, to do that would be so painful for him and for us and for my mother, you know? So they're just things that we would just, boundaries that you simply wouldn't ever cross. And so it wasn't simply like, oh, well, boys don't do this, girls do this. It was like, no, it's actually like, this is how we take care of each other. We're going to do this, right? So that we are recognizable to ourselves still. So my brother isn't put into that position of doing this. And so so, you know, I think so it was not so much, you know, I think that there is something here about, you know, the fact of that kind of what, again, you know, this idea of full-blown care, right? That is involved not just with taking care of somebody who's that sick, like my mother, but is involved with having children, you know, that that places in some ways the woman in this situation of just that kind of care. I mean, it's just not, and so that in a way that for a long time I felt that would, you know, that particular, that full-blown care would actually bring out that would annihilate me, because it would be from not just from the outside, it would be from within myself, that those aspects of that which is there already, it would actually annihilate me. And so there, it's that question of the lethality of care that in relation to self-knowledge, right, that I actually in some ways discovered by just even talking to my sister about the fact, like, why do you not want to have children? Or like, what did you think of that? Like, or, you know, that there was some way in which reproduction and lethality were linked for us in the context of our lives, not just in general or not for other people, but like just in the context of our lives, that it came to be linked in this way.
Oh, I see. Oh, thank you so much for again like clarifying this with us. I was maybe in like a different context. I guess like it is in a different context, but I guess like for my own work, I was also thinking about how like care is often talked about within the confine of white respectability. I guess if in ethnic studies, like you don't really see that as often. But then I was like still a little like disturbed by how in the very dominant scholarship about care, it is like dominated by like white females who want to like elevate the work of care, and care is has this like really like moral like connotation that often like exclude, like women of color from their framework. So I think like when I was reading your work, I was thinking about like I didn't think about this in terms of like lethality, but I think there is some like connection there to how like morality like often consumes the discourses on care. So yeah, thank you so much for telling us more about the context though. It was really illuminating. And I have taken up a lot of your time, so I see that the time is like almost up. But yeah, there is a final question that I wanted to ask you, and that is, what is your next book project? Can you tell us about interesting work that you're doing now that you have finished your book?
So many projects. I mean, I think that so there's I mean we're, there's like I mean actually a couple different directions. Like one is I am actually writing two different papers. So I don't know if it's going to actually turn into a book. I mean, these are going to be for edited volumes. But basically looking at the way in which Ella is in some ways the way in which Ella is actually learning death at dying, my daughter. And so I just so and also to kind of really get us to rethink dementia and the discussion around dementia in anthropology and kind of more broadly in the humanities as not one that isn't simply just a question of memory and recognition and so forth, but what it is actually have, be in dementia, like all of us be in dementia in the sense of a we might think of it more as a terminal disease in which like all of your bodily functions actually deteriorate, so you completely kind of unravel. And what it is for Ella to actually learn this. And so that's I've been kind of working on that. I mean, obviously this is difficult in the midst of a pandemic when there is no childcare and so and caregiving is difficult too for my father. But yeah, so that's one of the that's one area that I've been working on. The other is the this very, very large study that Vina Das and I are actually working on across 5 countries with multiple teams to look at basically how it is that households are kind of how it is that households are responding to COVID pandemic measures, low-income households in 5 different countries. So I'm actually so this is Chile, Brazil, India, China, and South Korea, in fact. And so we've been doing, because we can't do face-to-face research, we've been doing like WhatsApp video calls with the people that we, participants that, people that we've actually known for a very long time in our field sites. This is one of the kind of things that, anthropology keeps in touch and actually has very deep connections with the people that we work with. And so we've actually gone back to the neighborhoods that we've worked in long term, and actually have been following the families. We did household surveys and interviews every other week for 5 months, and then have been doing monthly follow-up interviews. So this this research has actually been really, and you know, I'm primarily working in Chile, and then we have graduate students who are working in South Korea, but this has been a huge undertaking, and one that hopefully we'll actually be able to kind of share with the public as we do more data analysis. But so it's like lots of different directions in terms of projects.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing. And they both sound really important. And with the first one, we didn't really get to talk about this in the interview. I did really appreciate how in the in part four, mother tongue, you give details on how Ella's learning loss and affliction. And I really especially love like the metaphors, you know, the tree metaphor, and then how it usually also like picks up on like, you know, simple details about, you know, like your father and as she learns about loss and affliction. So I really looking forward to, you know, reading it when it comes out. And then the second project also sounds really amazing as well. And I'm really curious because, yeah, like Brazil and Chile and the South Korea, I imagine, are very different contexts. So it would be really interesting to see what results come out from, you know, the surveys and interviews that you're conducting with different households.
Oh, yeah, no, it's been very, very interesting. I mean, because the pandemic measures also have been so different. I mean, between, for example, Chile, Brazil, and, for example, South Korea, I mean, with the kind of surveillance that's in China, we also try to also, the surveillance is quite different. And and the ways in which one relates to the state is very different. So also the political context, I mean, this, although there's actually a lot to look at, and so hopefully we'll be able to share that more
Definitely, I can imagine.
Once we work on our data analysis.
A lot of like historical, like political, like social policy, and then also like individual, I guess relational, like a lot of things that you can look into. But thank you so much for the podcast and the interview. We really appreciate your time, and I cannot wait to like read your next work.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Thank you.